First, I would just like to say it's truly an honor to be here today addressing this particular audience. So I'm just going to plunge in with a reminder about the horrific events in Paris in January and November of last year, and bring them up to suggest that they may have had the paradoxical effect of reminding the world that France still matters. How can we forget Je suis Charlie, the red, white, and blue flags draped everywhere, the illuminated monuments, the Facebook pages bathed in red, white, and blue? Then again, France was not alone in November. Beirut was struck the day before, the Russian airliner full of tourists the week before that. Yet the calls for global empathy on behalf of the fallen citizens of Lebanon and Russia was much slower to develop across the digital superhighway. Can these recent hateful attacks and the different responses to them help us as a specific community, French historians working largely in North America, to answer the questions that our wonderful co-organizers of this conference, Lauren and Katie, put to me and Brett for this lunch session? In general, can we make France and French history matter in a profession only focused on the comparative, the transnational, the global? In particular, do those of us who have dabbled in modern French colonial history have any special insights to share? As we all know, the outpouring of support for the Charlie Hebdo journalists and the victims of November 13th was cast as support for a particularly French way of life. On both occasions, the dead included several children of immigrants born on French territory, young provincials pursuing their dreams in Paris in a tradition that goes back at least as far as Eugène de Rastignac, tourists drawn to the City of Lights, and temporary residents like the American-Mexican University student Noemi Gonzalez living out her love affair with French fashion. How many of us here have done that? But at the same time, the values of the Universalist French Republic, which since 1789 has styled itself as a global fraternity, also came to the fore. President François Hollande insisted that France was attacked in what it holds most sacred, freedom of expression, the Republic, and human equality. An article in the British journal History Today, shortly after the attacks, agreed, I quote, "France has once again become the symbol of universal values that are at present under threat." Well, oui et non, one is tempted to say, not least because President Hollande's invocation of la patrie en danger has led him to propose that convicted terrorists be stripped of their French nationality, a move that part of the left has denounced as extremely uncomfortable for its reminders of the denaturalizations under Vichy. Now, the very politicized nature of this debate may be more about the upcoming presidential elections in 2017 than anything else, since laws already exist that allow la déchéance de la nationalité. Yet the politics of the moment should not let us forget that the perpetrators of the attacks were not only French citizens, but mostly citoyens from families with roots in former French colonies. That these particular citizens chose to join a distinctively 21st century armée révolutionnaire should give us pause. Clearly, these young French men and women did not feel a part of the nation and the republic in which they were brought up. Understanding why requires, I think, a deeper attempt to understand and confront the history of modern French colonialism. This brings me to a second and related argument in favor of doing the history of French colonialism as part of keeping French history relevant. Even with the incredible dynamism of the field, there is still so much to be done. Here, however, rather than listing for you some of the directions in which I see the field of French colonial studies moving, I would like to cast a glance at Perfidius Albion to see what historians of the French Empire, of the British Empire, have been up to. Why? The simple fact is that historians of British colonialism started much earlier than historians of France's empire, with a rich proliferation of studies on every aspect of the empire to draw upon. They are now posing extremely broad and provocative questions from which, as proverbial latecomers to the table, French historians, colonial or not, can benefit. Here I'd like to suggest four possibilities. Needless to say, there are many more. First, historians are asking if they can even speak of a British Empire, given the legal pluralism that characterized so many of the bits of the map painted in pink. The same can obviously be asked, indeed is being asked by some here today, of France's fewer bits of blue scattered around the globe. Why call its disparate protectorates, trusteeships, unions, colonies, departments, in short, its chaotic pluralism, an empire at all? In the same vein of questioning, historians of Greater Britain have begun to think harder about whether there really was anything distinctive about the way the Britons went about colonizing, beyond the longevity and the sheer extent of the process of conquest compared with other colonizing nations. Weren't all empires, after all, instruments for enhancing the wealth of the home country with the same apparently genocidal capacities, if not tendencies? If the question regarding the uniqueness of any empire hardly seems new, some startling new answers have been provided by students of British expansion that, again, French historians would be remiss not to engage. Here I come to my second example. The historian James Bellick, himself a New Zealander, has suggested in his book, Replenishing the Earth, that a unique Anglo-settler revolution took place in the 19th century, driving out explosively from two metropolitan centers, the northeastern United States and Great Britain. Unprecedented in scale and justified at the time in terms of an intertwined racialist and settlerist ideology. The Anglo migrants who peopled the American West, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and Southern Africa combined a kind of folk egalitarianism with a belief that abundance without work awaited them in their new lands. Several factors account for this willingness of Brits to emigrate and found Neo-Britons, including most obviously the agricultural and industrial revolutions and the end of the Napoleonic Wars. Both fashioned new tools of empires and supplied men and women who could wield them. Equally decisive, however, was a change in attitude in 1815 that Bellick intriguingly ties to something very concrete. Boosterism for emigration that appeared formally in pamphlets, but also informally in the many letters that passed from migrants to the new lands back to the many family members in the old lands, encouraging ever more Anglos to make the dangerous and difficult journey out west or down under. The result, ostensibly, was the rise of a global, multi-headed English-speaking world, unified by language and culture, a British imperial system with no formal existence, of which we North Americans were very much a part. Despite France's long-term demographic decline in the 19th century, can its one case of modern settler colonialism, French Algeria, be made to fit this model? Bellick argues no. There was no explosive emigration to Algeria from any part of France comparable to the massive export of peoples from the Atlantic archipelago from 1815 on. This despite the fact that France, too, until at least 1870, considered itself a country of emigration. This failure of droves of French to leave for either Algeria, Quebec, was not because in the 19th century, French peasants dreamed of different things than their more peripatetic British counterparts. French rural folk, too, wanted to consume more meat and white bread, which the settler colonies of the 19th century promised. No, France was missing something else. Listen to Bellick's characteristic Anglo put down of French exceptionalism. And I quote, "What the French lacked, and the Italians before 1880, were strong links and easy transfers to settler new lands, and therefore trusted letters back from them." This single sentence seems to me full of intriguing possibilities for further exploring the role played by the birth of the modern post office, rising literacy, the revolution in transportation and communication technologies, in creating and sustaining not only the neo-France that Algeria did become, but also a global France in its own right. Sticking to settler colonies for one more minute, no one, of course, needs to be reminded that Algeria's colon ideology was as violent as anything that those more mobile Brits carried with them in the 19th century. My third question then becomes not what was unique about Britain's precocious world system, but what all settler colonialism shared. Here, too, there is a contentious debate going on among students of British colonialism, which can be summarized as whether or not settler societies, because they rested on a disavowal of the indigenous presence, were always eliminationist, usually with the collusion of the law. There's now a significant body of research to maintain that the largest number of genocidal episodes within the Anglo world occurred in colonial settings, more particularly in areas of British settlement in North America, the Pacific, and South Africa. But there have also been studies trying to break down who exactly did the killing. Were perhaps the Irish and Scots themselves colonized by the English more prone to massacring Native Americans and Australasian Aborigines? French historians are, of course, already examining colonial violence, but they might productively undertake more research on the various sub-imperialisms and their legacies that also characterized French overseas territories, evident, for example, in the concerns of French settlers, military, and administrators in Algeria for their southern and western borders, and Lyotte's aggressive initiatives in Morocco. Meanwhile, in addition to issues of conflict, we also need to explore the complex circuits of exchange that were another facet of all imperial systems, projects, worlds, whatever word we settle on. Various groups of missionaries, feminists, socialists, humanitarian, administrators, sailors, collectors, experts of all kinds, were networked throughout the empire along gender, race, class, professional, and religious lines in ways that we have yet to understand. Last, but certainly not least, what about the place of race? Here, too, a comparison with the Anglo world is instructive. Studies of race in the history of modern British expansion abound, books on welfare, colonial law, the regulation of prostitution, especially in India, have all put race front and center for decades. If there is revisionism going on here, it is to claim that the ideas and the politics of race, in particular colonies, were more unstable and localized than once thought. Racial categories did not necessarily exist to be incorporated into colonial policy. Race was made and unmade locally in a multitude of ways. With regard to France, an increasing number of scholars are seeking to understand how colonial history has helped to shape a particular kind of race relations in the French Republic today. Yet they are facing a starkly different situation than in the Anglo world, because in France there remains an official aversion to acknowledging the power of race and racial discrimination in society. Ever since Vichy, the French government has refused to collect racial statistics. The Republic assumes that all are equal before the law and that all particularisms can and should be neutralized in the public sphere. From the point of view of the state, race has not existed in France since World War II. Now, my point here is not to rehearse facts that we all know or are familiar with, but to suggest we need not only more localized studies of how race has been produced politically in France and in its colonies to deny certain groups full equality. Equally important, we need to understand what the refusal to name race since 1945 has meant for the history of both post-war race relations and anti-racism in France. In the work that I've been just starting now on post-war anti-racism, I've been struck by the fact that the head of UNESCO's anti-racist campaign, Alfred Metraux, noted in 1958 that he could think of no French sociologist apart from Roger Bastide, who was working in Brazil, who studied les relations raciales at a time when race institutes were proliferating across that Anglo world traced by Bellick. This unwillingness to mobilize race as an analytical category that can bring to light relations of power has its own complex history in France about which we know surprisingly little. Undertaking histories of modern colonialism that are also histories of a kind of mobile friendship, that is to say, histories that follow people and ideas, material objects and forms of violence, commodities and technologies, specimens and germs, back and forth between French center and many peripheries, or from colony to colony, from world capital to world capital, hardly exhaust the possibilities of continuing to make the last 200 years of French history relevant in our own times of hypermobility. It would be more accurate to reverse the statement and insist that the recent tragedies in Paris make it almost unimaginable to write an effective history of colonialism without tethering it to the present. And on this note, I'd like to end by quoting a recent article by the historian Nancy Rose Hunt, was comparing rape and war in the eastern regions of the Democratic Republic of Congo today with the sexual violence that occurred in exactly the same parts of Leopold's scandalous Congo Free State over a century ago. Although few reformers at the time of Leopold discussed the violence done to women, they were much more taken with the severed hands. As Hunt puts it, tethering the past to the present need not be about continuity or causality. One context did not necessarily produce another, but there are repetitions to which historians need to be attentive, both for what they fail to reproduce from the past and what they do. French Republican political culture in the 21st century is rightly much admired around the world, in my opinion, yet this culture still does not belong to all French, regardless of background. The same can be said of the United Kingdom. To its credit, it passed the Race Relations Act in 1965, but structural racism persists, creating there too fertile ground for new hatreds to arise. As the 52 dead from the attacks of 7/7/2005 in London tragically remind us, three of the four perpetrators in the London attack were British-born, and the fourth came from Jamaica, a part of the Commonwealth, the Anglo world. For these contemporary failures of inclusion in both of the former imperial nations of France and Great Britain, colonialism and its post-colonial residues still have much to answer for. Thank you.